From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. The new movie, Charlie Wilson's War, is based on the book by the late journalist George Crile. On today's Fresh Air, we listen back to an interview with Crile. He'll explain how, during the 1980s, Congressman Charlie Wilson aided in the smuggling of weapons and ammunition into Afghanistan for the Afghan Mujahideen in their fight against the Soviet Union. Wilson funneled money to the Afghan fighters through his position on the House Appropriations Committee and with the help of a CIA operative. We'll also talk with Charlie Wilson himself. He has since retired from Congress. And we'll remember R&B bandleader and rock and roll pioneer Ike Turner. He died this week at the age of 76. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. The war in Afghanistan in the 1980s, between the Afghan fighters known as the Mujahideen and the invading Soviet army, transformed the world. The Afghans won with arms and training covertly funded by the CIA, and their victory contributed to the fall of communism. But the American backing of the Afghan jihad led to many unintended consequences, which America continues to face in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iraq. Who was behind American support of the Mujahideen? That's the story of the new film Charlie Wilson's War, based on the book of the same name by journalist George Kreil. Kreil described our support of the Mujahideen as the biggest and most successful CIA covert campaign in history. George Kreil died last year at the age of 61 after suffering from pancreatic cancer. Charlie Wilson, a former Democratic Texas congressman, was an unlikely figure to back a so-called holy war. His reputation in Congress was as a seemingly corrupt, alcoholic, scandal-prone womanizer. Wilson was introduced to the Afghan cause by Joanne Herring, a conservative, fiercely anti-communist Texas socialite. In the film, Herring is played by Julia Roberts. Charlie Wilson is played by Tom Hanks.
Joanne, darling, dial down the religion.
What?
It could alienate people who support what you need.
It's luncheons like this that are raising the money we need.
This thing is not going to get done by ballrooms full of people in the Houstonian Hotel. It's going to get done by the CIA, Israel, Egypt, and Pakistan, and it's going to get done quietly. Now you start making people think we're trying to convert everybody to Christianity.
I was saved by Jesus Christ, Charlie, and I am not ashamed of it. My fervor is not about religion. It's about freedom of religion, which we have, they want, and the communists are slaughtering them for.
And I get it. Just tamp down the fervor.
But I can't modulate God's will, sweetie.
You can try.
Yeah.
Now, I got to get back to D.C. They've set up a briefing for me at Langley.
On what?
On getting the guns.
A scene from Charlie Wilson's War, which was directed by Mike Nichols. Aaron Sorkin wrote the screenplay. Later in the show, we'll hear Terry's interview with the real Charlie Wilson. But we'll start with George Kreil. Terry spoke with Kreil in 2003. He told Terry about the wealthy Texas woman who introduced Charlie Wilson to the Afghan cause.
She was a most unlikely figure, a Houston socialite who was part of the oil-rich world of Texas in the 70s, and an arch-conservative who most reporters at the time who wrote about her described her as a kind of mix between Scarlett O'Hara, Dolly Parton, and I'd like to throw in Arianna Huffington. In any case, she was totally the kind of person that could only be created in Texas. And she was General Zia-ul Haq, the dictator of Pakistan's honorary consul and his principal advisor on America, if you can believe it. And she was also a great, passionate, conspiratorial anti-communist. And for some odd reason, she came upon her once the Russians invaded Afghanistan, that if she could just put Zia-ul Haq, this magnificent Muslim dictator, and the Mujahideen of Afghanistan, who were heroically fighting the Russians without any weapons, if she could put them together with this congressman she had met, who had supported the independent oil interests so effectively, that she could change the world. That they would combine and they would go deliver a lethal blow to the Soviet Empire. And that's curiously just what happened.
Now, Congressman Charlie Wilson managed to get a lot of money from the CIA for arming the Mujahideen. How did he, as a congressman, manage to make that connection with the CIA?
With great difficulty. The CIA at all costs wanted to avoid having anything to do with him. They felt that he was a cocaine-sniffing, scandal-prone, skirt-chasing danger, you know, probably the most notorious, wildest man of Congress at the time. And their reaction when he came into their lives offering to increase their budget to fight a secret war in Afghanistan was to look with absolute horror at such an offer. They felt, with friends like that, we need no enemies. And what ensued was a knockdown, drag-out fight. But it was only possible because of the curiosities of Congress and his position on the Appropriations Committee.
How important was he on the Appropriations Committee, and how did that help him?
Well, if you think of our country is so huge, and the number of things that Congress has to deal with are just so vast that it all gets broken down into areas of responsibility. And when it came to the CIA, if you were not on one of several committees, you really couldn't even talk to them. And no congressman, no member of Congress had ever been able to insinuate himself inside an actual covert operation. That was a line that had been drawn and maintained very effectively ever since the beginning of the Cold War and the beginning of the CIA. But what you have is with the Appropriations Committee, where the money is actually spent, when you drop it down to the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee, you will have 11 people in the House responsible ultimately for deciding how much money the Pentagon gets, the NSA, the CIA, all the intelligence agencies. And Charlie Wilson was one of those 11.
No, he finally had an ally in the CIA. Who was the ally?
A most unexpected character named Gus Avracados. By the time that Wilson met him, he both had a very distinguished history at the CIA as a kind of, I call him the blue-collar James Bond, but also a person who had alienated most everybody. And he was very, very distressed with what he thought were the bureaucratic cowardice that had come over the CIA and the domination of the agency by lawyers. And what happened in this case is that Avracados, who had been making his way in a very dramatic and bizarre fashion to a position in the Afghan task force, had encountered Wilson's attempt to force the CIA into a larger war. And without telling any of his superiors, he took off in a car, went down to Congress, and entered Wilson's office completely unauthorized and confronted him with the challenge that if you think you want to fight the Russians and kill the Russians more than me, you're crazy. And he did it in such a way that it made Charlie feel that maybe he might physically attack him. He's a really tough customer. And from that moment on, the two of them began to engage in a partnership and what amounts to down and dirty plotting to figure out how, with Avracados' information of how things happen in the CIA and what Wilson should say using his power on the Appropriations Committee, how they could put the CIA into a box where it had no choice but to accept stunning amounts of money that they didn't want to spend.
How did they do that? What was their approach?
What he did is that he told Wilson exactly what to say to Bill Casey, who was then the CIA director. And he did it in the following way. He said, as soon as I leave, you call the director and say that you just got $50 million more that you can give to the CIA, and you want to know if they can use it. And by the way, I just had run into Gus Avracados, and I told him about this and asked him to look into it. And what Wilson always had in the back of his ace and hidden away that he could pull out is that Ronald Reagan's rhetoric was so powerful and his popularity so great that he would simply say, if you do not support the Afghans with everything they need and with the money I'm offering you, I'll go to the president who is calling for this support and complain. And he meant it. He meant that he would probably destroy the CIA bureaucrats. And nobody in a high position in the CIA had ever engaged a congressman willing to out them, essentially. Terry, can I give you a context here?
Sure.
If you think back to that time when this story begins right after the Russian invasion of Afghanistan, Christmas of 1979. Just about a month later, the Afghans are a lost cause. The whole world has come to recognize with 100,000 Russian troops in Afghanistan, with the invincible Red Army occupying the country, that the story is over. And the terrible scenes that were broadcast around the world of the Afghans beginning to flee their country and the beginnings of what came to be called a genocidal war were very evident. And there was nothing really that they could do to change the picture. They just had World War I rifles and hunting rifles and this ferocious fighting spirit and conviction. But at that moment, they had nothing really that could help them other than, as in a fairy tale, they needed a heroic figure to emerge out of somewhere and magically come to their rescue. And there was such a person, curiously. But at that moment, he was stepping into a hot tub in Las Vegas at Caesar's Palace in the Fantasy Suite with two naked women with cocaine in their purses. And it is so odd to think that this is the man, Charlie Wilson, Congressman Charlie Wilson, who will get himself out of the hot tub and pull himself together in about a year and a half after this, discover the Afghans, discover this cause, and for a period of about 5 years, he will emerge as the centerpiece in the biggest and meanest and most successful CIA campaign in history and will be responsible for giving or making possible a total victory for militant Islam in the greatest jihad of modern history.
The late George Crile, author of the book Charlie Wilson's War. The new film, based on Crile's book, stars Tom Hanks as Representative Charlie Wilson and Philip Seymour Hoffman as CIA operative Gust Avrokotos. Here's another scene from the film. Wilson and Avrokotos are having a drink in the congressman's office.
Do you drink?
Oh, God, yeah.
Well, should we try? This scotch is going to release sarin gas when I open it.
I don't think so, but open it over there.
How'd a guy like you get into the agency?
What, you mean a street guy?
You ain't James Bond.
You ain't Thomas Jefferson, so let's call it even.
Good deal.
Since there's no other reason I should be here, let's assume it's because I'm very good at this.
Later in the show, we'll have an interview with the real Charlie Wilson. And we'll continue Terry's conversation with George Crile after this break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2003 interview with George Crile. The film Charlie Wilson's War, based on Crile's book, opens next week.
Was the CIA very interested in supporting the Afghans? I mean, you talk in your book about how this was one war in which the real enemy, the way they saw it, the real enemy, the Soviets, could actually be directly engaged. It wasn't a war with Soviet proxies. It was a war with the Soviets themselves. Was that very appealing to the CIA?
Yes and no, but mainly no, in that they didn't want to do it in the way that Wilson and Avrokotos ultimately forced them to do it.
Too risky?
Yeah, much too risky. I mean, what had happened by that year, or by that time in the early 1980s, the CIA had more or less established a pattern of conduct where they were engaged in endless war. It was almost as if it was viewed as permanent campaigns on the fringes to contain the Soviets. And the one thing they didn't want to do is to take on any kind of provocative campaigns that could escalate into some unforeseen drama. And in the case of Afghanistan and Pakistan, they had no choice but to use General Zia, the military dictator of Pakistan, President Zia, and Pakistan as the base of operations. And it was provocative because the United States, for the very first time, was supporting anti-communist guerrillas who were moving to kill Soviet soldiers. And that had curiously, had never happened in the Cold War. It was the very first time that the United States actually set out to kill our enemy, to mount operations designed to kill Russians.
So the CIA didn't want the Soviets to know that it was that Americans were arming the Afghans to the extent that we were.
There was a kind of a sense that we could get away with a lot if the United States was just sensible, and that if it did a calibrated escalation, in which the idea would be to win fantastic propaganda victories, which we were doing, to inflict a certain amount of pain, which we were doing through blowing things up and killing a certain number of Russians. But what changed the dynamic here completely is that Wilson, in conjunction with Gustav Rakatos, transformed the whole idea. They suddenly decided to hijack a covert policy and to take the United States for the very first time in the Cold War into a all-out, winner-take-all confrontation to turn the tables on the Russians and give them in Afghanistan their own Vietnam. It was sort of payback time in their minds. And it was something that the CIA at all costs wanted to avoid doing. And it was a knockdown, drag-out fight that stretched over a couple of years and then ultimately resulted in a total victory for Charlie Wilson.
Were there any concerns in Congress or in the CIA or in the Reagan administration that the United States was going to be arming Islamic fundamentalists with high-tech weapons, training these warriors how to use the weapons, while knowing that a lot of the Islamic fundamentalists hated the United States? They didn't just hate the Soviets.
There was certainly a good deal of concern inside the CIA in the early years when Charlie Wilson was trying to force them to escalate this war. And one of their perfectly understandable concerns was that, you know, what happens afterward? What are the unintended consequences? Is it a good idea to get is to make this a huge war? Would it provoke a Pakistani or an attack by the Red Army, the Russians, on Pakistan? What consequences could that have? What are we going to do with all of these Muslim fundamentalists? What kind of weapons, what kind of training is appropriate to give to them? And all of those questions were very real and part of the initial battle that the CIA waged to try to prevent this massive escalation. But the truth is, once they got into it, once they lost the battle with Charlie Wilson and the secret partner, Gustav Rakatos, helping him from within the CIA, once they lost it and the money started to flow in and the war started to escalate and the tide started to turn, the CIA became absolutely giddy and thrilled at this battle, because it was the first time that they were actually setting out to kill the enemy, to engage him in a winner-take-all battle. And no one thought that this was possible to win, but they increasingly came to think it would be. And then it happened. And for the longest time, this was viewed as the great triumph of the CIA in the last campaign of the Cold War.
How long do you think it took for the CIA to start thinking about the blowback, about the bad unintended consequences of arming the Mujahideen?
The simple answer is that they really worried about it, but didn't think too much about it for a long time, because so many incredible things were happening. Almost immediately after the Russians withdrew, after this thing that President Zia of Afghanistan called the miracle of the century, when the Red Army turned tail and walked out with their own Vietnam haunting them, everything started to tumble. You know, that wasn't very long before the wall came down, and it wasn't long before the Velvet Revolution and the fall of communism. Too many things were happening that were too exciting for anyone to worry about what was happening inside Afghanistan. And because it was a secret campaign, and because people didn't really understand that it had been a huge victory, there was no sense of accountability to the Afghans, or a sense that we had to worry about whether we had a responsibility to stay in there and try to help rebuild the country. So it was the blowback concerns, the whole sense of the unintended consequences, probably didn't really set in until the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993.
George Kreil, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
George Kreil, author of the book Charlie Wilson's War. The film, based on Kreil's book, opens next week. It stars Tom Hanks. Kreil died last year at the age of 61. Coming up in the second half of the show, a conversation with the real Charlie Wilson. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth in foster care, on the web at aecf.org. From the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. And from 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment, presenting the Irish rock film Once on DVD Tuesday. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we remember R&B musician and producer Ike Turner. He discovered Tina Turner and was a rock and roll pioneer. Ike Turner died this week at 76. And we'll continue our conversation about Charlie Wilson's War and hear from the former Texas congressman himself. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. The new film Charlie Wilson's War is about the American secret support of the Afghan Mujahideen in their battle against the invading Soviet army during the 1980s. At the time, Charlie Wilson was a Democratic congressman from Texas. He took on the Mujahideen's cause as his own and became one of the leading figures behind their covert funding. Terry spoke with Charlie Wilson in 2003 and asked him why he felt so strongly about the Afghan cause.
I was outraged, of course, Christmas of 1979 when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan for no reason other than simple aggression. And I thought that, well, this will just be another case of 6 weeks, and they'll pacify the country and kill all the fighters, and it'll just be another satellite. But after several months, it began to dawn on me that the Afghans, without weapons, were killing Russian officers in Kabul with knives and stones and anything they could get their hands on. And then it became clear to me, and I think this is the most important single part of this war, it became clear to me that the Afghans had made a decision themselves, without American or any Western participation, but they had made a decision themselves to fight till the end if they had to fight with their bare hands. And I just strongly felt that people that brave, that were that opposed to being subdued by the evil empire, if you will, that we would be damned by history if we let them fight with their hands. And so that my interest was aroused there. And after another few months, I made a trip just to see for myself as much as I could see along the border there. I had been friendly with Pakistan before this. And when I visited the hospitals and saw the children with their feet and hands blown off by the Soviet mines that had been disguised to look like toys and that sort of thing, and I just became radicalized.
Now, at the time, you were living a lifestyle very different from the Afghan Mujahideen. I mean, you were hanging out in casinos, hot tubs, relationships with beauty pageant queens. Is there an example you can think of the most unusual coming together of cultures, your culture and their culture?
Well, let's see. There certainly wasn't an example that had anything to do with alcohol, because I didn't do that in front of them. I suppose the fact that I was single at the time, and I've been traveling to exciting and exotic places, you like to have someone to share it with, and so I suppose the fact that I wasn't married, and they saw me with different Western girlfriends, was a major shock to them. Although they never gave any evidence of it, they didn't lift an eyebrow.
There's an expression called blowback to describe the unintended consequences of a war. What surprised you most about the blowback after the Afghan war with the Soviets?
Of course, and I take my full share of the blame, but and at the time, I didn't realize how serious it was, but the United States, once the communist government had fallen, once the Russians had left, we sort of lost interest, the United States and other Western countries. And because of that, we created a vacuum. And Afghans in a vacuum tend to fight each other for power. And there were many of them that had been radicalized on the Islamic side from their war with the godless Soviets. It was largely our responsibility, because we should have stayed there and we should have insisted that they somehow work together. We should have held out a lot of carrots and more or less forced them to work together, or at least not to go to war with one another. And I was surprised by that. The Taliban then, when they really came in and totally filled the vacuum, and many people in Afghanistan supported the Taliban that did not adhere to their religious beliefs or to their philosophy, but simply because they saw them as the first chance to have order in 15 or 18 years, to not have war, I was stunned and totally surprised. Felt very badly about it.
Anything you would do differently if you were going about helping to arm the Mujahideen? If you're doing that again?
No.
You do
nothing
it all the
same. I do differently. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yep. Now, what I would do differently, profoundly differently, would be to try to prevent, and I don't think one congressman could have done it, but I would have tried to prevent the immense distraction that our country had with the falling of the Berlin Wall, with the freedom in Poland and Czechoslovakia and all the others, where we just completely were distracted from the problems in Afghanistan. I would try to persuade the administration. That was the Reagan administration and the first Bush administration. It was extremely sympathetic to the cause of the Mujahideen. And I would have tried to persuade them to not leave and to not to maintain an American presence and to do whatever was necessary in the form of a mini Marshall Plan, not only in our own interest to keep something like the Taliban from gaining control of the country that provided a refuge for Osama bin Laden, but also to say thank you, because these people are the ones that shed the blood that defeated the Red Army for the first time it had left its barracks since 1945. And we owed them a great deal, and in my view, never properly said thank you.
What are some of the things you think the CIA did to try to hide the fact that it was funding the weapons for the Mujahideen and that it was funding intelligence? Yeah.
I don't think that the Soviets were ever fooled. They were fooled for the first few years, first maybe till 1983, something like 84. They were fooled by the magnitude, but it was taking us that long to get everything in the pipeline. As the book points out, the Chinese connection, the Egyptian connection, and all the rest. But I think that they knew that that it was a far bigger piece of cake than they had intended to bite off in 84 and 85. And then in 86, when the Stingers started shooting down their high-end helicopters, which were their major and most effective weapon, then they knew it was a fight to the death.
What went through your mind on September 11th when you heard, when you found out that it was Islamic fundamentalists who were behind the attacks?
Well, I was very grievous and devastated, and somehow I knew that I felt very badly about that. I didn't feel conscience-stricken. I just felt sad that... I felt sad of the cruelty of the attacks and the fanaticism of the attacks, and the fact that they obviously were coming from radical Islamic people, who I still felt that we were in great debt to many of, for really driving the nail in the coffin of the evil empire. And then to see them not on our side was a tough nut for me.
Well, Charlie Wilson, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You bet.
Charlie Wilson speaking with Terry Gross in 2003. The film, based on the book Charlie Wilson's War, opens next week. Coming up, we remember Ike Turner, who died earlier this week. This is Fresh Air. Musician and songwriter Ike Turner died Wednesday. He was 76.
You know, every now and then I think you might like to hear something from us. Nice and easy. But there's just one thing, you see. We never, ever do nothing nice and easy. We always do it nice and rough. But we're gonna take the beginning of this song and do it easy. But then we're gonna do the finish rough. It's the way we do Proud Mary. Rolling, rolling, rolling on the river. Listen to the story now. Left a good job in the city.
Turner used to be most famous for his musical partnership with his wife, Tina Turner. Then he became famous for having beaten her after his portrayal in the movie What's Love Got to Do With It, based on Tina Turner's memoir. But in the early days of rock and roll, he had a track record as a songwriter, talent finder, and record producer for small Southern rhythm and blues labels, doing sessions with such now legendary figures as B.B. King and Howling Wolf. As the leader of his own rhythm and blues act, he wrote and arranged the songs, played piano and guitar, and choreographed the steps. Turner did time on drug charges in the early 90s. Then he made a comeback, which was jump-started with the success of Salt-N-Pepa's recording of Shoop Shoop, based on Turner's song I'm Blue. Ike Turner's place in the history of rock and roll begins with the record some critics consider the first rock and roll record ever made, Rocket 88. Turner co-wrote the song and played piano. The singer, Jackie Brenston, was the horn player in Turner's band. Terry spoke with Ike Turner in 1996 and asked him about the story behind that song.
Well, we was on our way to, we stopped by where B.B. King was playing it down in Mississippi, and he made an appointment with Sam Phillips at Sun Recording Studio in Memphis. And we didn't have any original tunes. All we was doing was covers on the radio at that time. And he asked us to bring some original tunes, and I told him okay, and we didn't have any. And so anyway, on the way up there, we was counting cars, like how many Fords should we see, how many this cars we see, you know. We make bets on, I see more Fords than you do Plymouths and stuff like that. And so anyway, a Rocket 88, they were new at that time. I think they came out in 49 or 50, somewhere back in there. But anyway, we was counting cars, so finally, Jackie said, hey, man, let's do one about that fast car. I said, okay. And so we started writing about the Rocket 88.
You women have heard of jalopies, you've heard the noise they make, but let me introduce my new Rocket 88. Yes, it's straight, just one way. Everybody likes my Rocket 88. Baby, we'll ride in style, moving all along. Smart and designed, black convertible top, and the gals don't mind. Sporting with me, riding all around town for joy. Blow your horn, Raymond, blow!
Now, the vocal on Rocket 88 is done by Jackie Brenston.
By Jackie Brenston, yeah. He was the baritone player.
Now, did you want to sing?
Me? No. I've never liked to sing. Even now, I do it on stage, but I don't like to. I like to teach other singers to sing and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Tell us what a show featuring Ike Turner's Rhythm Kings would have been like in the 1950s, in the days before Tina Turner was part of the group.
Well, what we were doing, we were just basically, we did everything that was hot on the radio, and then we would do the songs that we were, you know, the recording that we were doing, basically like that.
Well, how did you discover Tina Turner and add her to your review?
My drummer was going with this girl named Aline Bullock, which is Tina Turner's sister. And we were playing like, 13 jobs around St. Louis a week. And we had a big following of women in those days. And so Tina's sister, Aline, she kept telling me to, why didn't I let her sister sing? Because there were some people we would call up on stage as guests to sing. And so anyway, I never would call her. So finally one night while we were playing, my drummer, I didn't see him. I was up there just sitting down playing the organ on a break. And then all at once I heard this voice coming out of the speakers, and that was Tina. And I said, dog, that girl can sing, can't she? So, she had a good voice, you know. But, you know, I didn't care that much about women's voices, because then I don't know what women, if any, that they had back in the time doing R&B. Because Tina, at that time, I started her to singing songs that Ray Charles would sing, or whatever man that was popular, not Jackie Wilson, I don't think he was out then. I would have her singing what they would sing. And so, anyway, I had this guy named Art Lasseter that was staying in my house over in East St. Louis. And so Art, I wrote a song for Art Lasseter. And so I had the studio book for one day the following week. And he didn't show up at the recording studio, long story short. And Tina was sitting there every night when I was teaching him the words to the song and teaching the girls the background. And the song was A Fool in Love. And so when he didn't show up at the studio, and we had waited there about an hour, hour and a half, and I was paying, I think it was $25 an hour then, which was a lot of money in those days. I think it was 1960. Tina said, well, I know the words you want me to sing, and when you find him, and then you put him on it. And so I went and asked the engineer. He said he could do it, because I think then we only had two tracks. And this guy, all he did was commercials, so nobody never streamed over his microphones and things. He was really ticky about his equipment. And so this song, A Fool in Love, if you notice on there, when Tina holler, hey, 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 wow, when she holler like that, man, he hit the table, said, God damn it, don't holler on my microphone, you know, because he had never heard nobody holler like that on a microphone before, you know, and he stopped the machine, and he pitched it, you know, so anyway. She hollered again, but he put her way back in the corner from the microphone, so when she screamed, it wouldn't peg his needles or what. I don't know if they had limiters then or not.
All right, well, let's hear the record, recorded in 1960. This is Fool in Love.
Oh, there's something on my mind. Won't somebody please, please tell me what's wrong? You're just a fool, you know you're in love.
Now, that record was released under the name Ike and Tina Turner. Mm-hmm. And Tina's real name was Annie Mae Bullock, and you were not yet married when you changed
her name. Her name is Martha Nell Bullock.
What is it?
Her name is Martha Nell Bullock.
Oh, okay. Why did you change her name to Tina, and why did you make it Tina Turner before you were even married?
Before we were married, that's something we discussed some other time, but this marriage stuff. But anyway, after we recorded the record, Tina was going with the saxophone player in my band named Raymond Hill. Raymond and I, from a kid, as I told you, when we was in school, he was in the group with me, blowing saxophone in the band. And so anyway, she got pregnant by Raymond, and I knew that as soon as I come up with a hit record on her, that he was going to come back and snatch her. And so what I did, I made up the name. I sat down and wrote down different names, like Sheila. Well, I'm going to tell you in the end, like, where this type name came from. I was thinking more jungle, like Tarzan and stuff like this.
Mm-hmm.
My head was picturing this type thing. This is why later on, Tina had the wig on, and her and the Icats, they real rough on stage, and the show I have now is the same thing. It's like a lot of real rough dancing. It's more jungle, wild, raw. Well, what it was, when I was a kid, there was a white lady, a blonde lady that used to swing through the jungle. Her name was Nayoka. I don't know if you ever heard of her, but if you go look at some of the real old movies, you'll find her. Her name is Nayoka. She do just what Tarzan do. She swing through the jungle and fight lions and things like that. And, man, I used to be so in love with this woman. And I used to go sit in the front seat of the movie and try to look up on that little thing she had on. She had a little tiger skin, and I would be trying to peep under there, look, you know. But anyway, I was in love with this woman. I made Tina subconsciously. I wasn't aware that this was what I was doing. I made Tina the woman that I was in love with in my childhood.
And but I don't get the way where the name Tina fits in.
Okay, Nayoka was the woman's name. Yeah. Nayoka. Okay, so I sat down and I wrote down names like Sheila, because that sounded like jungle to me. Tina sounded like jungle to me, and so I just made the name up Tina.
Tina sounds like jungle to you. Okay.
Yeah, to me. Yeah, I don't know what it sounds like to you.
Fair enough.
Okay.
Ike Turner speaking with Terry Gross in 1996. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's conversation with Ike Turner, recorded in 1996. When we left off, Terry was asking Ike Turner why Tina recorded under his name.
But she had the name Tina Turner before you were married.
We won't get into this marriage. Yeah. Okay, I said one time.
Go ahead.
We never was married in the first place, not even until today. Oh. Okay, so if you're going by what you saw in the movie, I never saw the movie, but the movie was a lie. So back to the records now.
Wait, you never saw the movie?
Huh?
You never saw the movie?
No.
Why not? Were you?
When I read in People magazine that she said that she hated that movie and that guy, whatever the guy's name that produced the movie, he said that he wasn't cutting them. He didn't do that movie for Tina. He did it for Walt Disney and I knew it was real bad. And then people started telling me, man, wait till this movie come out. It's gonna really ruin you. You know the way they portrayed you. Even Larry Fishburne told me that . He told me that I would appreciate what he did to it to make it better than the way they had it. And so everybody told me about it. And then people started thinking that movie was me.
Well, another question about the movie and also about Tina Turner's memoir. In her memoir, I mean, she also portrays you as having abused her during the years that you were together.
Well, you know, today, I'll say this, today... They call everything abuse. If you holler at your wife, if you discipline your kids, you holler at me. If you dominate and tell your kid, no, don't you go out that door. That's child abuse. And if you spank him and set him down or something, somebody next door going to call the police and put you in jail for child abuse. So, you know, on that subject, I kind of stay away from that because I'll say this. I'm very proud of the way that I was that I raised my kids. We raised four kids, I don't feel I've ever, I've been dominating because I'm very, I don't compromise music at all. But as far as like for music is concerned, when I say I want something one way, I was very dominating and stuff like that. But as far as abusing my family, abusing her and stuff like that, sure, I have slapped her. She have slapped me. We just live normal people lives, but by me being having the notoriety that I have, it's been totally exaggerated, you know. And so I stopped defending myself against it. And so anyway, everything's fine now.
The group Salt and Pepper,
yeah,
had a hit, the Shoop Shoop song. Yeah. That was based, I think, on one of your songs. Is that right?
Yes, that's based on I'm Blue, the Gong Gong song by the Ikettes I did in 1961.
I don't have a copy of that. Would you sing a few bars of your song?
I'm blue, blue, be, do, be, no, shoe, be, do, be, do, be, blue. Hey, it would like that. You don't remember that song? Or you was Gong Gong? How old are you? That's the wrong thing. That's the lady, huh? Okay, this was out in 1961. It was a real big hit for the Ikettes. And Salt and Pepper, they sampled. Actually, that's the Ikettes and that you hear on that record in that part when they said, "You make me wanna shoot, shoot, it, doop." That's us on there. I hope they do some more of my records. So far, I got like $500,000 from them. You know, I hope somebody else do it. Okay.
Ike Turner speaking with Terry Gross in 1996. He died this week at the age of 76. And now, before the show ends, there's something Terry wants to say. So here she is.
Thanks, David. Actually, I'm here to do something that I don't want to do, which is to say goodbye to one of Fresh Air's producers, the producer of Fresh Air Weekend, Ian Chillag. The good news is that he has a great new job in New York at the new NPR program, The Bryant Park Project. The bad news? Well, there's so much about him we're going to miss. His great writing, his always creative production style, his sense of humor, and just the pleasure of working with him. He's incredible. No matter how hard he worked on the show, he'd still have energy to run and win medals and marathons. On the bright side, maybe I'll feel less out of shape after he leaves. Well, we wish him good luck, but with his talent, he doesn't really need to rely on luck. But speaking of luck, our colleagues at the Bryant Park Project are really lucky to have him. Congratulations, Ian. We'll be looking for your work on the air, on the internet, and on the page. David, I think I need a moment of reflection. Why don't you do the close credits?
Fresh Air is produced by Danny Miller, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Roberta Sharrock, Dorothy Farabee, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhivar, and, I'll miss saying this, Ian Chillag. One of Ian's favorite performers is Johnny Cash, so we'll let him have the last word. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli. Thank you.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line. I find it very, very easy to be true. I find myself alone when each day's through. Yes, I'll admit that I'm a fool for you. Because you're mine, I walk the line. As sure as night is dark and day is light, I keep you on my mind both day and night. And happiness I've known proves that it's right. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble and the Barnes & Noble Review, the new online literary magazine with reviews, interviews, and recommendations. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art, now exhibiting sculptures by Martin Puryear. More at moma.org. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and health care of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I was singing R&B back in 62 before you were born and your mama too.
On the next Fresh Air, musician Betty LeVette. She talks about returning to Fame Studios in Muscle Shoals to record her new album, The Scene of the Crime. It's the same studio where she recorded a never-released album in 1972. Join us for the next Fresh Air.